Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks, to the first forum of the Sydney Institute in 2018, and Warren Mundine makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, this time on the occasion of the recent publication of his book, Warren Mundine in Black and White, Race, Politics and Change in Australia. I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. He's very well known, so he's been an activist, he's been a columnist, he's been an advisor to business, a former national president of the Australian Labor Party. He was appointed to Indigenous advisory bodies by two Labor and three coalition prime ministers, and he chaired Tony Abbott's Indigenous Advisory Council between 2000, or the coalition's Indigenous Advisory Council set up by Tony Abbott between 2013 and 2016. But tonight, on the, as I mentioned, on the occasion of the publication by Pantera Press of Warren Mundine in Black and White, and their copies to be sold after that for those who haven't got it. So we welcome Warren Mundine to talk tonight on the topic of race, politics and change in Australia. Warren Mundine, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction. I'm pleased to be here at the Sydney Institute to talk about my book, Warren Mundine in Black and White. And I wish to thank Anne and Jared for their invitation and inviting me along. And yes, I think this is my second time here as a speaker, but I've attended many Institute functions. First, I'd like to tell you a bit about my book and how I come to write this book. It's available here tonight. Available here tonight, but we're here tonight on the traditional lands of the Gadigal people, a stone's throw from where the first fleet landed almost exactly 230 years ago. And I recognise and pay my respects to the Gadigal ancestors and elders and my own Bunjalung, Gumbanga, Yuin and Iris ancestors and elders. The Gadigal clan were one of about 29 clan groups from the Greater Sydney area. They were the first group Captain Arthur Phillip came into contact with when he got on land here in Sydney Cove. Arthur Phillip is a fascinating man, a very enlightened for his time, and who made efforts to understand, even protect Aboriginal people, and to learn the local languages and customs. Much of this he learnt from an Aboriginal man named Bennelong, who was captured some months after the First Fleet landed. Bennelong was from another of the 29 clans, the Wangal clan. Bennelong stayed in the colony for about 6 months, living in Phillip's home and learning English before escaping. Months later, he returned to the colony voluntarily and was given a house, and which is now called Bennelong Point, where the Opera House is. He even went to England with Phillip and had an audience with King George III. Bennelong was the first Aboriginal person to straddle two cultures, to live both in the ways of the Wangal people and in the ways of the British. His story includes bravery, exploration, friendship, conflict and sadness. I'm a great believer in the power of stories to build understanding, make connections and to promote ideas. Through the story of Bennelong and Phillip, we gain a better understanding of the relationships between Britain and the First Nations of the Australian continent. It teaches us about the nuance, the difficulties and the possibilities. My own memoir took about 5 years to get down on paper. In truth, it took about six decades. I wasn't born then. No. It's a story about what made me who I am today. The people, the ideas, the experiences that all come together to make me who I am. But the story goes back even further to the ancient influences of the Bundjalung and Gumbenga kinship systems, through to the first contact between my ancestors and the first Europeans to make their way to northern New South Wales, through to my family's experience during the near century of segregation of the New South Wales Aboriginal Protection Act. Through my early years in country New South Wales and then Western Sydney, and my decades working in community, business and then in politics, through to today, where someone like me, who spent the first 13 years of my life living under segregation, advises prime ministers and then represents Australia at the United Nations and the OECD. My dad was a Mundine. My mother was a Donovan. The Mundines and Donovan families modelled courage and pride in everything they did. Both my parents and me and all my brothers and sisters were born into segregation. We were second-class citizens regulated under the New South Wales Aboriginal Protection Act. Mum and Dad had to fight battles just to do normal things others took for granted, like sending their kids to school and buying a home. My father needed a certificate of exemption, which is there on the screen, from the Aborigines Protection Act, to travel from home after work without being arrested. This is the photo of that certificate. We called them dog tags. For nearly a century, all Australian states and territories had Aboriginal protection laws, a system of control of all aspects of life. The system allowed governments to remove Aboriginal children, impose segregation, and banned us from having a drink in the pub. The Welfare Board told Aboriginal people on reserves where to work and then could take their wages. You see, the picture on the certificate is damaged. My mum scratched it out. She hated that Aboriginal people needed a certificate and to carry it around everywhere just to do what other Australians could do. Despite all of this, my parents had the courage to face the reality around them as it was, not how they wished it to be. And they had pride in themselves and in their kin to believe they could achieve. They believed Aboriginal people could do anything if given the chance. And their children and grandchildren have proven them right. The book is also a story of Australia through the perspective of an Aboriginal family. Many people have contacted me to say how much they learnt from my book about Australia, things they never knew about even though they lived through those times. In fact, I was just downstairs at another institute in the Energy Policy Institute, and I was pulled up by a couple of the mining executives there who grew up on the North Coast, and they said they remembered those times, but they didn't quite understand what it was. And they read the book and they thought it really enlightened them on that process. A lot of what Australians know, or think they know, about Aboriginal people is two-dimensional. When I was at school, there was very little written about Aboriginal people in any of the books I read, even in Australian history books. Information about Aboriginal people is now compulsory in the school's curriculum. In New South Wales, it has to be taught in all subjects, something that I've been a critic of. However, I don't believe the narrative has become any more insightful. A lot of what is taught is cliched and simplistic. Some of it is really making a political point. There's no sense of the nuance and the complexity of the history of our cultures. My book covers a lot of history. It reflects my understanding from what I experienced myself, from what my family had talked to me about, and from research and study. Some of that research actually surprised me. In fact, I thought my grandfather only had a sister, but it turned out my great-grandfather was a bit more active, and I've discovered a few other families in my tree. I learned a lot about my family history that I didn't know before, as well as about Australia's history and politics. There will be a few surprises in there for the readers. It wouldn't be my book if I didn't slay a few sacred cows. This is my memoir. It reflects my perspective and my understanding of the way things had been. And by understanding that, you will come to understand me. And a little bit more about Australia. I'm proud to be a Bundjalung man, I'm proud of my Goombanga, Yuin and Irish heritage. I'm also proud to be Australian. I say that in my book. Some people will wonder how I can be proud of Australia when my family, my ancestors and I were treated so badly in its history. Now, I'm very honest about these bad experiences in the book. I lay it all out there. Ray Hadley read the manuscript and provided a review, which is on the back of the book. After he read it, he called me and he said he found the first part of the book very hard for him to read, to go through that history of what it was like then. We're both of similar ages, and he also grew up in the north coast of New South Wales as well. But he pushed on, and I urge you to do as well. It gets better. Otherwise, we wouldn't be standing here today. What I also say is this. No nation is founded on purity. Even nations that are standard bearers of liberty and justice, models of progressiveness and enlightenment, have bloody and brutal histories. Human history is a record of humans, the brutality of which humans are capable, and the incredible capacity of humans to advance, learn from wrongdoings, build better societies, and improve the quality of all life. I don't judge a nation by the worst of its history, but by how it overcomes that history in its vision for the future. And on that measure, I judge Australia very well. It's an interesting week to be talking about race, politics, and changing Australia with the Australian Day on Friday, and what has become the annual shout fest on whether Australia Day should be continued to be held on the 26th of January. As our national day, Australia Day should be a day for celebration, patriotism, pride, and reflecting on where we're headed as a country. But January has again become dominated by the debate over what date Australia should be celebrated. This year is particularly aggressive. Aboriginal people who publicly supported retaining 26th of January have been racially abused and even physically threatened. The Change the Date campaign, and this is by other Aboriginal people, by the way, the Change the Date campaign is now led by far leftists, both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, whose political face is the Greens. As their campaign intensifies, so does pushback from those opposing change. I'm on record as saying Australia Day should be changed, and I chose the date of the 1st of January, the anniversary of Federation, when Australia was created, although I don't think it's a priority and I don't campaign for it, and I'm not too sure if I want to lose another public holiday being a good Australian. For me, 26th of January signifies conflict and conquest, a date I want to commemorate but not celebrate. Even if it is moved from the 26th of January, we should not forget what happened from that date. And also, many Australians are of descent from those convicts who were dragged out here, not by they wanted to be here, or by the military who come. I want the date for our National Day moved because I wanted to celebrate Australia, not because I don't, because I'm proud of Australia. I'm proud of this continent's First Nations, of the oldest continuing nations in the world. Australia itself is one of the most youngest nations, formed on the 1st of January 1901. So our continent hosts one of the youngest nations of the world and also the oldest nations of the world. We are unique. In 1901, Indigenous Australians weren't full citizens and lived under segregation. This changed in 1967. I'm proud of that moment. Proud change was achieved with the highest voting result in Australia's history on any referendum. Australia was founded on great principles of Western civilization. Democracy, free markets, the rule of law, separation of religion and the state, social pluralism, individual rights, and great British institutions, the Westminster government, common law, liberal rights. If you were setting up a new nation and wanted to adapt the best, you couldn't do much better than those principles and those institutions. I'm proud of Australia as a migrant nation. Some of Australia's early migrants were from China, joining the gold rush in the 1800s. Afghanis also come in the 1800s as cameleers, working in outback transportation. Most Chinese and Afghans who migrated in those early days of colonisation were single men, and many went on to have families with Aboriginal women, and hence some of the interesting names in the Aboriginal community of RC and Abdullah and so on. In the 1900s, Australia continued to receive migrants from all over the world, enriching our society just as it enriched my life and my family's home in Auburn in the 1960s. This happened despite the White Australian Policy, which operated from 1901 and was abolished between 1966 and 1973. According to the census, Australians are descended from over 300 ancestries, a tapestry of physical features, languages, religious beliefs, cultural backgrounds, and even football codes. We probably have the world's most successful multicultural nation where, with few exceptions, people from everywhere have settled cohesively as neighbours, workmates, even family. All Australians can be proud of this continent's shared 40,000 years history, comprising its ancient past, Western civilization, British institution, and cultural richness from two centuries of immigrants. I'm proud to be Australian. I'm proud Australia has achieved these things no other nation has. Australia was independent, but we didn't fight a bloody revolution against a colonial power. We separated from Britain through legislation passed by Democratic Party, our parliament. We're a peaceful democracy where human rights and freedoms are upheld, even though we don't have a Bill of Rights. In Australia, Indigenous rights were won through democracy and through legal process and not violent insurrection. At the 2017 United Nations Expert Mechanism on the Rights of Indigenous People, I met delegates from many countries with Indigenous populations. Few come close to Australia's records in protections and respect for Indigenous people and culture. And some are still as bad as what Australia was in the past. To these who condemn Australia because of history or claim it's still a racist nation, I say, name me another country with Australia's diversity that's better, more harmonious, more respectful of difference, more embracing of its Indigenous heritage than Australia. Australia is a secular society. All religions can worship, but we have no official religion. Australia, founded in the Christian traditions and several national holidays, are Christmas holidays, yet no one is obliged to embrace any beliefs. Australia's culture is unique, not British, Aboriginal or migrant. The Australian way is pragmatic, easygoing, direct and laconic. The Australian way is to be comfortably laughing at itself and everything and everyone else. It's not easily upset. Living on this continent has been far too challenging for that. It's tough always and heroic when called upon. It looks out for others when needed, but respects people living their lives without external meddling. Live and let live goes both ways. Australia isn't divided by class. It was when I was a child and Aboriginal people lived under segregation, but today anyone can achieve anything. Those who think Australia has class divisions should spend some time in places like Britain or India to see what real class division is. In recent weeks, I've seen social media posts by Change the Date activists talking about the day of mourning and protection and protest in Sydney on the 26th of January 1938. As evidence of long-standing grassroots Aboriginal campaign to change the date. I wrote about the day of mourning and protest in my book. It was the fourth ever Australia Day and the 150th anniversary of First Fleet's landing, and all the state premiers had gathered in Sydney. The Australian Aborigines League and the Aborigines Progressive Association used the event to highlight the past and ongoing mistreatment of Indigenous people under British occupation and a campaign for equal rights, including full citizenship. This protest wasn't about changing the date of Australia Day. They didn't even mention it. It wasn't about the resentment of Australia. It was quite the opposite. I quote from the speeches and resolutions in my book. They demanded inclusion, to be treated as Australians with the same opportunities as other Australians, able to fully participate and progress as part of a modern and successful nation. They didn't hate Australia. They wanted to be part of it. Aboriginal people campaigned tirelessly to be fully part of this nation. And in 1967, when we celebrated. The truth is, the Green Left didn't want to celebrate being Australian on any date. To the far left mindset, patriotism is racism, nationalism is white supremacy. The Green Left aren't proud of Australia's achievements, cultural and way of life. They're embarrassed, even ashamed. They don't support Australia's growth and prosperity. The Australian that they'd be proud of is some imagined utopia delivered through their socialist anti-Western agenda. This agenda is fundamentally founded on the idea Australia shouldn't be touched beyond its current level of development. No extractive industries, no remote or regional development, not even by Aboriginals on their own land. Policies that drive electricity prices up and reliability down, industry and jobs offshore. The Green Left agenda will take us to the same sorry place as every other socialist country. Broke, corrupt, hungry, and never knowing when the lights will be on. I didn't expect the Green Left will ever change, but the political centre should know better. Instead, it too often appeases the Green Left agenda, privately knowing it's economic vandalism, but publicly too cowardly to tell urban voters that Australia can't be anti-development, anti-everything, as well as prosperous. I talk about this in my book too, and I quote Colin Powell, the former four-star general and Secretary of State of the United States. In his book, It Worked For Me, in Life and Leadership, he wrote, "No good idea succeeds simply because it's a good idea. Good ideas must have champions, people willing to believe in them, push for them, fight for them, gain adherents and other champions, and press until they succeed. Bad ideas don't simply die because they are intrinsically bad. You need people who will stand up and fight them, put themselves at risk, point out the weaknesses, and drive stakes through their hearts." To me, these words summarise the problem we have with Australia's political centre, which I believe is a crisis of political leadership. Political leaders today don't have the courage or determination to champion what they know is needed to fix Australia's problems and secure Australia's future. They aren't championing good ideas and pressing them until they succeed. And they don't fight the damaging and sometimes downright stupid policies and practices that are beginning to take hold. They are not driving a stake through the heart of bad ideas. The political centre is paralysed and afraid. Afraid to upset some noisy interest group. Afraid to make some part of the community unhappy. Afraid to take anything away regardless of whether it's affordable or actually achieving anything. Afraid to tell Australians the truth about things like the national debt, the welfare reform, the retirement age, electricity policies, mining and industry, and corporate tax. Australia's political leaders are telling people what they want to hear. Great political leaders tell people what they need to know. They have a clear vision of what they want for their country and where the country fits within the world and champion the reform needed to get there. They don't get frightened north or meekly propose a change in the face of heated opposition. They step up their advocacy and communicate why sometimes it's important. They craft their own positive stories and narratives. They tell people, this is where I'm going to take you and this is how I'm going to take you there. The foundations that have made Australia a great nation are also under threat. At this core, the Western principles and free market system that underpin Australia are ideas, good ideas. They need champions. They won't simply survive because they are good. There are many threats to these principles. There are people who want to undermine and displace them. There are competing and consistent ideas that cannot be reconciled with Western principles, and at some point we may have to make a choice. No culture, even as strong and as good as Australia, is set in stone. Countries are consistently adapting to changing world and changing dynamics. But the adaption can be positive or destructive. When I see intellectuals and commentators, educated people question democracy because they don't like the candidate who was elected, for example. Or when I see university students at institutions I always revered violently protesting against free speech because they don't like what someone has to say. Or when I see Christians being fired from their jobs or pushed out of office because they don't support certain changes to the marriage law. Or when I see people suggest we make blasphemy illegal in Australia, or that Sharia law principles can have a place in our legal system. These are examples of threats to the principles and institutions that make Australia great. These are examples of bad ideas that won't die simply because they're intrinsically bad. Just as the principles and institutions of which Australia was founded will not prevail simply because they are good. We can't take our way of life for granted. Australians and Australian political leaders must stand up and fight for the principles and institutions that made Australia a great nation, and they must drive a stake through the heart of those threats. That's the message of my book and my message for Australia Day. Thank you for listening.
Many thanks to Warren Mundine for great speech to start the year. When I introduced you, I probably should also have said that in late last year, and I think going into this year, you're also a presenter on, you have your own program on Sky News, which is called
Mundine Means Business,
which is, but also relates to business, so that's on Sky News. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we've got copies of Warren Mundine in black and white. I'm sure Warren will be happy to sign them after the event. We'll do the signings in the boardroom, which is just outside the door. So that's for when we get rid of questions and discussion, and so we start now. Can I start off? You dedicated your book, as I recall, to your parents and their Catholic faith, and I think this is the first illustration in your book. Yeah. Which I think that date is 1956, isn't it?
1956.
56, yeah. But your father signs it, and that's quite an educated signature for a man of his generation. So just tell us a bit about the education that your father, Mundine, and your mother, Donovan, had in those difficult times for Indigenous Australians in places like New South Wales and Queensland.
Yeah, that signature actually makes me sick. It's 10 times better than mine. My father and my mother only went to fourth class, which is year four now, is it? Yeah, something like that. But they were a very proud people and very strong about education. Even though their education was cut short because they went and worked on properties, and my father worked on cattle stations and so on, and my mother, of course, was a domestic in that. They never stopped about the idea of education, and they read a lot. I was just amazed, how much they read, and they absorbed and listened and learnt to do things. So it was an interesting time for them, that they didn't get the full education they deserve, but they are the two of the most interesting and educated people I think I've ever met. Mm-hmm.
So, the question for you,
thanks for a wonderful message, Warren. If the British settlers hadn't arrived in the Sydney Cove on 26 January 1788. What would the left-wing and Aboriginal activists have preferred to have happened instead?
They'd probably be abusing us in French. because La Perouse came a couple of days later. His boat wasn't quick enough. So, yeah. Look, I'm a great believer in history. History you learn so many lessons from. And, in fact, I use it in everything I do in regard to how I operate. You can't change history. You can't change the past. The past is there. What you can do is learn the lessons of the past and read the past and take the knowledge of the past to build the present and the future. And that's all you can do.
There's a question up here. Yep.
Thank you for the speech. I have a question about the future of Aboriginal advancement and Aboriginal integration. It seems to me that at the cost of some simplification, there are two basic models. The first one is integration and assimilation, which would necessarily mean the disappearance of traditional Aboriginal culture, or alternatively, some kind of a separate development and the maintenance of Aboriginal culture. Do you see any conflict between those two alternatives, and which one do you think is the way for the future?
What's happening is there was an extensive process of trying to do away with Aboriginal culture and languages. You see the result of those languages, how many of the 500 languages of Aboriginal society are still alive today and still spoken on a daily basis. But what's happened in the last 30 years is this renaissance of Aboriginal culture, where Aboriginal people are coming out and being proud of who they were, and a lot prouder than what I was as a kid. You know, when I grew up in that period, we were considered, you know, it was almost an embarrassment. They used to always, put us down. Aboriginal was bad, and so on and that. But today, the pride of the young and the pride of the people who are growing up is incredible. But the issue is about how do we bring these 40,000 years, 60,000 years, whatever it is, scientists seem to find things new every day, and the current modernity that needs to happen between the cultures and moving forward and building a really strong Australian nation. And now, as I said, I'm very proud of the Western principles in regard to democracy and Westminster government. I love the Westminster government and the way it operates, and I love the rule of law. You know, we may not agree with some of the laws, but at least we have the opportunity through this process to change those laws and to make differences in that. But we need to have those strong, sound basis of society, and I see. And it's happening in an almost an osmosis process. You see, on the TV show, we interviewed Galarrwuy Yunupingu last December, and he's running a mining company up in his country. Yeah, yeah. He's got a timber company operating on his country. They just did a deal with NASA to look at the development of a space launching pad on their country. And it's amazing, and you've got to look at Galarrwuy. He's got to be one of the most recognised traditional people in the country, and he's taken on this modernity, but he's doing it in a Yungul, which is his culture, a Yungul way of doing things. They set up a couple of years ago an assembly, a national assembly for the Yungul people, which brings all the clans together, and they sit there and talk about their laws and customs and what they need to do. And then they even have heated discussions, like, because they're looking at one of the things was manhood ceremonies, they found a problem with some of the young men who were, 13, 14, 15, did their ceremonies and they didn't go to school because they thought they finished their education. Well, they had an incredible discussion about should we make finishing the HSC part of the manhood ceremony. And that's the bringing together of cultures and people. And it's a great discussion. I sat there and I just listened, sort of like on the fringe of the parliament. And it was, and these are the things that are, so my belief is that we need to come together, we need to work together, and work to the future.
Mm. John McCarthy? Mm.
Warren.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry,
that's right.
Just go.
Yeah. Put it up to
push the button.
That's the way.
That's it.
Warren.
Thank you. Warren, the biggest issue involving the Indigenous in the last 12 months has been the Uluru Declaration.
Yes.
And this has engendered a very significant social heat,
yep,
political heat, both within the Indigenous community and between wider Australia and the Indigenous community. Warren, when one comes down to it, what was being proposed was that there be a consultative council for the Indigenous that was to be enacted,
yep,
through an amendment to the Constitution. One could imagine, Warren, that Parliament may have reacted in a different way in relation to a consultative council if it had been open to Parliament to enact that by statute. Now, it wouldn't have given...
You've only got to keep this brief.
Right, I'm just going to finish. I'm sorry. That gives me another minute. Warren, what is it... And where do you stand on the idea that there ought to be a consultative council in the way that it was proposed? And do you see it as feasible that there could be some agreement reached with the wider Parliament for a consultative council that was statutorily based?
That was one of the recommendations. There are a number of other ones that it was put forward too, which, you know, I'm supportive in a way. Like the Makarrata Commission, for instance, in regard to a treaty process, I support that. That's treaty-type processes, and on public record, I'm supporting those processes. But I don't believe in a treaty. I believe in treaties, because, as I said, there's a number of nations around that they need to negotiate with. I don't have a problem with a representative body. We've had representative bodies in the past through statute. And also, we have some representative bodies within the ministries. And over a number of years, they had good and bad results, some of them. I'm not a supporter of a constitutional amendment that put a body within the constitution. I look at Australia's constitution, and anyone who does, I think I need to get a life, actually, if I've read it and looked at it. It's not a very sexy paper. It's like a football rule book. It just tells you how to play the game, and you've got to work it. When you get on the field, you've got to work it out. I think you're right in regard to, if it would have said, you know, the Parliament, my legislator, set it up, that probably would have happened. But I think they went a step too far in regard to saying it has to be in the Constitution. I think there's a lot more we need to do before we get to that phase. And I'm not a supporter of having within constitutions race. I think we need to move beyond those processes. Yeah.
Not so much a question, but in October I went to Be'er Sheva for the Lighthouse anniversary, 100th anniversary of the liberation of Be'er Sheva and Jerusalem from the Turks. And there were 12 native Australians.
Yep.
50 years before that they could vote, before they were recognised as genuine human beings and not animals, their grandfathers and great-grandfathers had volunteered to fight in the Light Horse, and some had died there. So I really can't think of anything more forgiving than that.
Well, that procedure, I've been there, and it's an incredible memorial, and it's a great moving thing. But there are some falsehoods that are floating around. You know, the first one is voting. But in New South Wales, Aboriginals had to vote because they were British citizens, not citizens, British subjects, since 1858. That's a fact. I got my great-grandfather and my grandfather, who were on the electoral rolls, copies of that, where they voted around 1913 in those areas. So we've got to... And I know there's a quote that's put out there a lot, and Professor Toomey actually challenged that quote in regard to that we were considered under the fauna and flora as nothing more than fauna and flora. Well, that's not true. We may have been treated like that in some places and given bad things, but that was not the law. And a good example of that, and I know it's been chucked around a bit, was which had a good and bad result, was the Mile Creek Massacre. Well, the massacre was bad to happen in the first place, but there were 11 white people who did that massacre who were charged. And I forget the number, it was 6 or 8 were actually hung. 6, was it? They actually were hung for the murder of those Aboriginals. Now, that changed the frontier war system completely in the way it operated and how Aboriginals were treated, but under the law, we were still the British subjects. So, I think we need to go away from some of these myths and actually deal with the reality of how people were treated and what happened in people's lives and then overcome these things and how do we move forward. And a good example was the Mabo decision win in the High Court, which was done through the British system. And and John could speak more about that than me, being the barrister that he is. That's British common law. We won a battle under British common law. And I was looking at the National Native Title website, Tribunal. 80% of Australia is currently under the claim of Aboriginal groups, and Aboriginal groups have got about 80% of Northern Australia's water and land. So we're moving forward in that area. The big challenge for us now is with the land and that, how do we then get economic outcomes and improve our society's living standards and stuff like that? And that's the discussions that people are having. I just finished a two-week tour of Central Australia up through Uluru, through Katherine, and into the Pilbara and Perth and the suburbs of Perth. And that's what the conversation is about. How could we utilise our land now? Continue our culture, continue our beliefs and our language and stuff, but also have an economic outcome that lifts our living standards and builds a future for ourselves. And that's what it's all about.
Question here.
Thanks for your inspirational talk. We talked about the rich fabric of Australia from migrants, and I think it's important to realise that we are all migrants, except that some of your ancestors got here a bit earlier than the rest of us.
But we're good swimmers, yeah.
Congratulations. What I worry about is the treaty process creates kind of a quasi-apartheid system, which may not be helpful in weaving Aboriginals in as part of a rich Australian fabric. So I would worry about that and ask your opinion. More to the point, let me ask you a personal question. If you had a small child now going to school, would you prefer that in addition to English, he studied something like Mandarin or Spanish or an Aboriginal language?
I would like to see him learn several languages, and Aboriginal being one of them, the Bunjalung language or the Gumbanga language of my mother and father's. Because I'm not going to pretend I'm an educationist, I'm not. But educationists tell me that if you get kids and they learn several languages and that, it really helps in their brain development, helps in their educational process. So I'm a strong supporter of all Australians learning English and another language. And I've always been very strong about that. And it's important for us as an educated, moving forward nation and that. Yeah, I take on your concerns about a treaty, because when you get into negotiations, you go into things you don't know where they're going to come out. You may surprise yourself. But I believe it's a way of settling some old disputes and then moving forward as a nation.
So, there's a question here. Yeah.
Warren, the cashless debit card, what is your position on that, and what do you see as the future rollout of it?
In the beginning, I wasn't when it was put to us when I was chair of the the Prime Minister's Indigenous Advisory Council. In fact, the council wasn't great supporters of it, but we knew the government was going to go in this direction, so we wanted to make sure that if it was going to go in that direction, it had to be put in place as a non-discriminatory. So it had to be across the board. If you're going to go to an area, then it not only be Aboriginal people, but it's everyone who was on welfare within that area. And then we wanted to make sure that there are other things that were put in place in that. I think in regard to it, and I know there's a lot of conversations about this, I'm a supporter of it, and I'm a supporter of it going forward. And there are reasons for that. And when we looked at some of the close statistics and data that we're looking at, and having conversations, especially with women within Aboriginal communities, they were very strong about having that because of the violence, because of the alcohol use and so on. And then looking at the crime rates that dropped when those areas went in. That's only part of the picture, but I see the cashless welfare card as only part of the picture. There's also some myths about it. I know there was a lecturer at Sydney University recently, a friend of mine came to me and told me about it, a daughter, and a daughter told me what was said there. The myths are that people aren't getting their full welfare benefits. They are. It's just that 80% of it you can't spend on alcohol or gambling. You still get the money. You get it in the debit card. And some people like it, because I know a few people, Aboriginal people, wouldn't normally be able to access credit cards or debit cards. They're actually using it now to pay on trips to go on holidays and stuff. The other 20%, you can do anything you like with it. You can go out and spend the 20% on alcohol and just have a party if you want to. So we need to break through those myths and actually look at and listen to the results. Now, it's embryonic days. It's only a couple of years in place. I think we need to look at things that need to be tweeted in it and fixed. But I am a supporter, and it mainly because I spend a week, every month in Aboriginal communities in remote and regional Australia, and we need to break through some of the barriers and confront some of the issues that are there.
So you go there and then down to John.
Warren, just recently, and it's something that I've been thinking about for a while, there's been a discussion about this identification as Aboriginal, and with it comes a lot of perks. You can have scholarships and help with this and help with that. And there has been a debate, and some of the Aboriginal leaders have said that the real needy Indigenous people are not getting some of this help, because people who have 116th, 148th, whatever, connections with Indigenous ancestor, knowing how to use the system, can go along and get themselves into a university or a scholarship here or a scholarship there. Has any thought been given to the definition of who should be helped under these sort of schemes and who's really just using it?
To me, I have a basic thing, it's about need. If you're looking at welfare payments, looking at housing, looking at a number of things, it's about need. You need support, you need educational support. It's about that need that we should be providing. Now, myself, I use the example is, I don't need that support and need for that thing. That's for other communities. But there also is a lot of myth and legend about some of these areas where all these people are getting motor cars and all these people are getting these flash houses and so on. And that. But when you go to these communities, I can tell you that's not true. Some people are living in such dreadful housing conditions and stuff like that. So that's where we should be focusing our needs and that on. About, okay, I don't care if you're black, white or brindle, it's about need. We need to support those people who are in need. Australian taxpayers, I think, are very generous people. We're pretty laid-back people who always bend over to help other people, you know. And so I think, you know, we need to focus on that rather than some other people who are quite wealthy and doing things. Not that I'm quite wealthy, you just need to buy the book.
And it's a beautiful book. Warren, you opened the book with a story about Lionel Rose and why he was so important. Could you share that with this group?
Lionel Rose was an interesting person. I was going to say the word interesting is interesting. He seemed to be a man of his time. It was 1967, they had the referendum. He won the World Bantamweight Championship in 1968. And also undisputed, you know, these days you got A, B, C, D, and E, F, and G world titles. In those days, there was only one champion, and he won that. He fought the great fighting Harada in Tokyo and won that fight. For me as an Aboriginal kid, he come from a place called Jackson Tracks in Victoria, which was a happy town in the stock routes or that area, which was very common across Australia when after the that a lot of Aboriginal people lived on stock routes and other places because they worked for the cattlemen or the agricultural farms and that. And that's what his parents and his family did. So he lived in his abject poverty in a humpy. And it resonated with me because my family come from Byugal, and up until the 1970s, they lived in tin shacks and humpies as well. And my father grew up, he actually slept on the ground. That the humpy they had couldn't fit everyone. So it was the younger kids and his mum and dad, my grandparents, and they slept outside. The boys slept outside on the ground. So that resonated me, and here we was at 19 years of age fighting for a world title in Tokyo, Japan, which I had to look up on a map to find out where it was, and an atlas. And it sent a real clear message to me that no matter what your circumstances you were born in or you come from, you can change those circumstances. And he did it by being a boxer. Now, boxers have to be super fit. They're the fittest people around, actually, because in a boxing ring, you can't hide. When I was playing rugby league, if I got buggered, I used to slip under the wing and hide for a little while, then come back. But in boxing rings, you can't do that. And it showed me that if you want to change your circumstances, you've got to put in the hard yards, you've got to be dedicated and focused on what you want to achieve, then you can achieve it. And that was what resonated with me. What resonated for the nation, because it wasn't only just Aboriginal people, was it was at the time of change in Australia and how people viewed Aboriginal people. And here was this man who come back, and he come back to Melbourne, I think there's 100,000 people and turned up to give him a parade and everything. And when he got off the plane, he made the comment he thought the Beatles had just arrived. He couldn't work out why everyone was there for him. And when you hear his story, he was interviewed in one of the interviews when we were looking at some of the tapes and we were writing up about Lionel. Some of the interviewers asked him, and said, how important was it for you to be an Aboriginal person to win this world title? And what does it mean to you for your people? And he just said, I never thought about it like that. I just thought of myself. I was trying to achieve something, which is a world title, and do what I needed to do to win that world title, and I saw myself as a proud Australian. So that was his words, I saw myself as a proud Australian. And then he said, well, when you put it in that context, I suppose it does, these are not his exact words, resonate for Aboriginal people, because here I am as a person who's achieved, which a lot of Aboriginal people haven't, and so I hope that I could be that, you know, journey for people to go through. Now, and Australians just love that. And then he this humble, very nice person and that. And then he went on, I'm not a country and western person. I'm probably the only Aboriginal that doesn't like country and western. And he sung that country western song, which has become a big hit in Australia. And people always have fond memories of him. And he was an amazing, amazing man. I was very fortunate to meet him just before he died at a country and western festival at Dubbo, where I was on the council at Dubbo. And I walked, and I've become that 13-year-old kid again. And I walked up to him and I went, Mr. Rose, you know, it's really nice to meet you. And he said, oh, hello, how are you going? Shook my hand. He said, you know, you were an important inspiration in my life. You changed my life. And he said, oh, that's very nice. And then he walked on. So he was just a man of his time. And he was very popular and very loved by everyone, by all Australians. And in actual fact, I think a lot of people looked at him hoping that that would be how Australia turned out. That we're all proud Australians. And he was achieving something as a proud Australian, but he was also a proud Aboriginal. And that's the way we looked at it now.
And I think in that period of the 60s, you're in New South Wales and you're younger, but I think in chronological order, the turnout, huge turnouts in Melbourne in the 60s were the West Indies cricket team, the Beatles, Lyndon Baines Johnson and Lionel Rose. They were the four really big street turnouts in that period. Now, we're right at the end, so I'll just ask you a final question. I know you've been busy writing a book, very busy writing a book. But what other things are you doing at the moment apart from, I mean, you've written a book, your previous position as chairman of the Prime Minister's Council has not continued, so what are your activities these days?
Well, February last year, 27, 17, yeah, it was last year, 17, the Prime Minister, he asked me to stay on the council, and I said, no, I'm more interested in doing some economic stuff and focusing on economic development for Aboriginal people. And also, policy, I was getting a bit tired of just writing about policy and talking about policy. I wanted to actually do some meaty stuff. So I've met up with... for using my network, I was able to work with the Wanyi people up in the Gulf Country with the closure of the Century Mine, and we were able to negotiate with the MMG and now Century Resources that they took the Aboriginal people coming off the mine site working, set up a rehab mining company. So they cleaned up the mining sites, got it back to its natural, well, still working on it, a natural space it was. And so that's working. We're doing it, and I've got 20 people working out there. We're going to, by mid-June this year, we're going to have 125, 130 people, Aboriginal, most of them Aboriginal, about 80% of them Aboriginal. There's some technical jobs that we've got other people doing, but we hope to get some and encourage some Aboriginals to go off to university and take up those technical areas. There's that. I'm still writing with the Daily Telegraph, the Australian, and the Financial Review. Someone said to me, how do you write for the Financial Review, and which is Fairfax Media, and also then News Limited Media. And I said, well, you look at Jared, he goes on the ABC and fights. But and so you do those things, and but you're trying to get a message out. Even though I'm trying to still get a message, they're doing that. I'm in an employment service company. We're employing and getting people into jobs in Northern Territory and other areas. And we actually just got a contract back in New South Wales, so we'll be doing that. I did a job for Julie Bishop as the Foreign Minister, and I went off the OECD and the UN and argued the case about economic development is going to be the closing the gap difference for Indigenous people on a global stage. And now I've been appointed to sit on this OECD committee. So I've got this terrible job. I go to Canada and Peru and South Africa and other places personicating and talking and trying to get to policy changes to look clearly at economic development as the thing. And that's one of the things I'm really strong about. The thing in missing in the closing the gap, and I believe the gap will never close between Aboriginal and the rest of Australians until we focus on economic development, building businesses which employ Aboriginal people that do things, because that's globally what's happened. In fact, the last 50 years, the OECD had that report that said more people have been lifted out of poverty in the last 50 years through economic development than in the last 1,000 years. And that's what we've got to concentrate. That's what I think is missing from closing the gap. The other things need to be done, yes, education and health and all that stuff, but the key is needs to be in an economic development phase. So doing those things, there's 100 other things I'm doing as well, but it's, and then on Sunday afternoon I have a beer and relax, that's good.
Many thanks. But as I said, copies of Warren Mundine in black and white to be signed outside if you don't already have it. I'll be very brief. Look, on the eve of Australia Day, it's a truly insightful speech. And the book is a wonderful account of your life, but your parents who were always so concerned that to get on in life, whoever you were, wherever you came from, you had to work and you had to be as well educated as you could be. It's a great tribute to your parents and
your family. They should have been on the cover, actually.
They should have been on the cover. But they probably wouldn't have sold as many books. So congratulations.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.